This is Literature Out Loud, a podcast devoted to classic works of fiction, drama, and poetry. This is episode 1, Who Cares Who Conquers, in Keats's On First Looking Into Chapman's Homer. Picture this. You're standing outside a room full of people who have never heard of you, or if they have heard of you, aren't inclined to think much of you. Your job now is to walk into that room and say something that will knock their socks off and impress them. This is, for many people, one of their worst nightmares, having to do something like this. And as hard as it may be to walk into a room and talk your way into making a good impression, I think one thing that's even harder than that is to have to write your way into a good impression. For writers, that first thing that they publish, that first article or poem or story, this is the thing that will set the tone for the rest of their career. And this is the situation that John Keats found himself in on December of 1860, when he published for the first time a piece of poetry, the sonnet On First Looking Into Chapman's Homer. Keats today is one of the best-known poets in the English language, and On First Looking Into Chapman's Homer, or Chapman's Homer, was the first poem he published at the age of 21. And by all accounts, this would seem to be a great start for a young author. The poem was generally very well regarded, and in fact, it continues to be one of Keats's most beloved poems. It's been published in anthologies and collections of verse since the early 1800s through to the present day. It's also a poem that has been described as, or often described as, flawless or perfect. But this seemingly great beginning for a young poet didn't go as he hoped. The following year, Keats would publish a collection of his verse, which got mixed reviews and, more importantly, didn't sell very well. For the next few years, he would continue to publish poetry, all of which received, at best, mixed reviews, and none of which sold very well. And he eventually died at the age of 25 from tuberculosis. It's not until after his death that Keats's gifts were really appreciated or recognized. And of course now he is one of the most well-known and influential poets in the English language. But the other thing that's happened is that Chapman's Homer, this seemingly perfect poem, has been identified as having a mistake in one of its last lines. So neither the poet's life nor the poem itself goes exactly as we would like it to. So today, we're going to be talking about the poem Chapman's Homer and why it's such an interesting, important poem, but we're also going to be looking very carefully at that mistake, and we're going to raise the possibility that this mistake, or this thing that for so long people just assumed was a mistake, might actually be the literary equivalent of putting a lampshade on your head and dancing on a table. That is, a really bold, somewhat reckless, but daring move where the poet risks all in a bid for greatness. Now, I said that this mistake in the last line might in fact be a really innovative and daring move, and we can talk about that in a minute. But one of the things that's immediately, I think, innovative or daring about this poem is its subject matter. Keats has taken what has really got to be one of the most boring premises in the history of literature and turned it into something worth reading. On First Looking Into Chapman's Homer is a poem about exactly what it says it's about. This is John Keats remembering reading a translation of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. And it's important to note here that not only is Keats writing about reading a translation, he goes so far as to specify whose translation he's reading. And why is this so important? Why is it so important for Keats that he emphasizes that he's not just reading Homer in the original Greek, nor is he reading any old translation of Homer. He's reading Chapman's translation. Well, so, who is Chapman? That's the first thing that we've got to look at. Chapman here is George Chapman. He was a 16th century poet and playwright. He was a contemporary of Shakespeare's. And he and Shakespeare had some of the same patrons. Shakespeare used Chapman's translations when he was working on Troilus and Cressida. So Chapman's translations of Homer were published around 200 years or so before Keats writes his poem. Now, Chapman is a very interesting author, but by the time that Keats was writing or even thinking about reading Homer, Chapman's translation was not the translation that most people were reading. The translation that most people in Britain were reading was a translation that was written by Alexander Pope. Alexander Pope being a very famous poet and writer who was writing in the 1700s and whose translation was published about 100 years before Keats got around to reading anyone's translation. Again, it may seem like a slightly bizarre thing to do to specify which translation of Homer he was reading. But Keats here, by identifying Chapman, was actually being rather provocative. For one thing, most people had forgotten about Chapman's translation by the early 1800s, but it had been rediscovered by a small group of intellectuals who, upon reading it, decided that they absolutely loved it because it captured a lot of their fairly radical ideas about language and the language of literature, which they felt should be pretty much the opposite of Alexander Pope's. It may seem strange and even somewhat anal of Keats to point out that he's reading Chapman's translation, but it's quite significant. The difference between Chapman's and Pope's translations are striking. And just to give you an example, just to give you a sense of how different the two translations are, I'm going to read you the first few lines from the Iliad, that the famous opening where the poet describes the wrath of Achilles. Okay, so here, first of all, is Chapman's translation, which is again written in the early 1600s. And he begins like this. Achilles' baneful wrath resound, O goddess, that imposed infinite sorrows on the Greeks and many brave souls loosed from breasts heroic, sent them far to that invisible cave that no light comforts, and their limbs to dogs and vultures gave. Okay, that's Chapman. Now, here's Alexander Pope's translation in the early 1700s, same lines, the same beginning of the Iliad. Achilles' wrath to Greece, the direful spring of woes unnumbered, heavenly goddess, sing, that wrath which hurled to Pluto's gloomy reign the souls of mighty chiefs untimely slain, whose limbs unburied on the naked shore devouring dogs and hungry vultures tore. Again, I think the difference is just immediately obvious, right? Now, Chapman's lines are 14 syllables, which is a lot longer than Pope's, which are only 10 syllables. And what this means is that Chapman can stretch out his images, the same images that Pope needs to compress. So, for example, what Pope calls Pluto's gloomy reign, Chapman extends into that invisible cave that no light comforts, which is, I think, certainly more descriptive, and I think to my ears anyway, it's more arresting, right? So for Keats to point out that he was reading specifically Chapman's Homer, this wasn't just some innocuous, you know, I prefer one translation over the other kind of thing. It was in fact a statement that he was making about the language of literature. And this was a debate, or this was a subject of much debate during the early 1800s. Right? And just to simplify what is a really complicated and incredibly transformative debate, basically you had people in one camp who favored poetry that was written in a more formal, aesthetically polished style. And then in the other camp, you had people who wanted poetry to be written in what they would refer to as the language of men, right, or the common language of everyday speech. They wanted poetry, or they wanted literature to sound more kind of organic and natural as opposed to polished and refined, right? So, and I think just from hearing, again, if we think back to the Chapman versus the Pope, what's very obvious is that Chapman falls much more into the organic natural camp, and Pope falls into the more polished and refined camp. But by choosing Chapman, obviously, Keats was setting himself down in the naturalistic Chapman camp and turning away from Pope's style, which a lot of people at this time period were beginning to feel was almost artificial, that Pope's poetry, that style of writing poetry was too smooth and too perfect. And what was galvanizing about Chapman's translation was its roughness, its the feeling that it was more organic and less polished, and because of that, more sublime. So this sets up why Chapman's Homer, specifically Chapman's Homer, would be so important to Keats. But there's a whole backstory to this poem that's worth noting. The story goes that Keats and a friend of his, Charles Cowden Clark, who was a school friend, were up one night reading Chapman's translation, which presumably they had never come across before, or at least Keats hadn't come across it before. They were up most of the night, and then Keats walked home. The next morning, when his friend came down to breakfast, he received the first version of the poem. And like I said, although the poem's title suggests a fairly boring premise, we've already, you know, because we know now some of the background between Chapman versus Pope, we know how this poem might be more dynamic than what its title initially suggests. As I said before, Chapman's Homer is one of the few of Keats's poems that was appreciated from the moment it was published. Our contemporary critic Helen Vendler calls Chapman's Homer Keats's first perfect poem. Now, it's important to note that what she means by this isn't that the poem is flawless, but rather that this is the first poem that best captures the style of the poet that will mark the poet, in this case Keats, for the rest of his career. So even though we know, though, that Helen Vendler doesn't mean that the poem is flawless, the fact that she does refer to the poem as perfect is, I think, just interesting. Not necessarily ironic, but certainly interesting, considering that mistake, the maybe mistake, in the 11th line that I mentioned before, and that we're going to pivot to in a few minutes. But
before we turn to that, let's actually take a minute to read the actual poem. And here it is.
Much have I traveled in the realms of gold, and many goodly states and kingdoms seen. Round many western islands have I been, which bards in fealty to Apollo hold. Oft of one wide expanse had I been told, that deep-browed Homer ruled as his demesne. Yet never did I breathe its pure serene, till I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien.
So I want to begin by going back to the title of the poem, which at first glance seems a little clunky. Now, we know why Keats wouldn't have just called the poem on first reading Homer. It's obvious now that it's important to emphasize that it's Chapman's translation. But why wouldn't he call the poem on first reading Chapman's Homer instead of the longer looking into? I think that when you think about it, looking into is actually a great phrase because it emphasizes action, or more strongly implies action, specifically a sense of interrogation. You know, I'm going to look into this, I'm going to look into that. And that's more dynamic than merely reading, which seems kind of passive in comparison. The other thing about looking into that I like is that I think that it invokes the physical act of actually opening a book to look into it. And that in turn gives the title a kind of tactile quality that works well for the sonnet in a way that merely reading wouldn't communicate as well. So that's the title, and now that we've read the poem, we can start thinking a little bit more about what's happening in the poem itself. Once we start reading it, the first thing that I think comes up immediately is the first couple lines sound initially like the poem is about actual travel, that the speaker is recounting places that he's been to.
It soon becomes clear, though, that the places the speaker describes are books, or places that books and poems have taken him, not places he's physically been in. And what's crucial for him is that these places are governed not by your usual kings or emperors or governors or what have you, but by writers. So in this kind of literary map that he's traversing, bards hold the Western Isles for Apollo, Apollo being the god of poetry, and Homer rules a wide expanse. And what's, I think, important to extrapolate from this is that for the speaker, it's these writers ruling these literary lands who also rule his imagination, which means that the speaker is a literary traveler, but he's also the writer's subject. And this idea in the first six lines of the speaker being beholden or subject to a number of writers is very important to keep in mind when we consider what happens in the poem's last eight lines. And there's a transformation, I would say. Arguably, he stops being a subject and moves into a kind of different position. That's the first six lines. And then, of course, as I said, you know, the next eight lines of the poem, things shift. But before we talk about those next eight lines, I think, or as an introduction to discussing those next eight lines and the shift between the first six lines and the next eight lines, it's important to take a minute here to think about the poem's form. Form is, of course, always important when thinking about or reading poetry, and knowing even just a little bit about it, I think, really allows us to develop a much richer appreciation for a poem, any poem. In this case, Chapman's Homer is 14 lines, and it is a sonnet. It's not insignificant that Keats chose to write a sonnet, because the form is, or the form has, a fairly rich and interesting history, you know, in poetry in general, and then also in England specifically. So the sonnet was invented in the 12th century by Sicilian poets, and thereafter it spread from the south of Italy through the rest of Europe. But it didn't actually reach England until around the 1500s. The first time you see sonnets written in English are around the time of Henry VIII, or poets in his court who all of a sudden start to write sonnets. By the time that we get to the early 1800s, though, which is, again, Keats's period, the sonnet had, by this point, fallen into some obscurity and disfavor. It, as a form, it was considered old-fashioned and not particularly awesome. And just to give you a sense of this, there's a poem written during this period by the poet William Wordsworth, and the title of the poem is Scorn Not the Sonnet, which obviously means that there were a lot of people around who were scorning sonnets because he felt the need to write a poem defending them. One of the reasons, though, why the sonnet starts to move out of disfavor after a period of about 100 years when people kind of dismiss it, is because of a poet named Charlotte Smith, who's just an absolutely fabulous poet. I highly recommend reading her sonnets, of course, which was what she was initially famous for. But beyond that, she wrote this poem called Beachy Head, which is just fabulous. And we will hopefully talk about it someday. But in any case, the reason that Charlotte Smith is so important to the history of the sonnet in English is that when she starts to write sonnets, which she does, I believe, starting around the 1780s, she writes sonnets on topics other than love. So previously, sonnets were mostly written or considered to be appropriate for love poetry. But Charlotte Smith starts writing sonnets about a whole host of other things. And so that when Keats starts to write sonnets some 20 years later, he's writing in a form that has recently expanded in its capacity for expression and subject matter. And that at least partly explains why he's able to write a sonnet about translation and not romance. Okay, so all sonnets have 14 lines. You can't really mess around with the lines that much. But within that, there are things that you can do, most of which involve playing around with the rhyme scheme to make things a little bit more interesting. And I don't want to go too far into kind of formal categories here, I'd say, but the major thing to keep in mind is that Italian sonnets
generally don't have a couplet in the last two lines, which is to say the last two lines don't rhyme, whereas English sonnets do generally have an ending couplet. The last two lines do rhyme. And so, for example, this is just the last two lines of Shakespeare's sonnet, My Mistress's Eyes. The last two lines are, "And yet by heaven I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare." Rare and compare, the last two lines rhyme. Just to go back to Chapman's homework, the last two lines don't rhyme, and so we know that we're not dealing with strictly an English form here, that Keats has used a more Italian form for his sonnet. Okay, so as I said, so there are different things that you can do with the sonnet form. What most sonnets are famous for, though, is for including something called a volta, or a turn, which is when the mood of the poem shifts. And in the sonnet, the volta is most usually indicated by a change in the rhyme scheme. So in Italian sonnets, there you usually have 8 lines that follow one rhyming pattern, and then 6 lines that follow another. So the volta most often falls in line 9, which is, of course, the dividing line. English sonnets can do that, but they often also have a volta in the concluding couplet. So, again, Shakespeare's sonnet, My Mistress's Eyes, in that sonnet, the volta doesn't come until the concluding couplet, which is emphasized by the word yet, when you realize that even though his mistress isn't all that great looking, the speaker really loves her anyway. So Shakespeare puts his volta in that concluding couplet. One of the things about the form of the sonnet that has troubled people probably since it was written or since it was first created is that it can have, or it can seem to have, a lot of rules, right? Because you have to have a volta, and then there are all these kind of specific rhyme schemes, and then as the form develops, you have Petrarchan and Shakespearean and Spenserian sonnets, and they each have their own set of rhyme schemes to adhere to, and there's a couplet, and there's not a couplet, and maybe there's a couplet, and, you know, so on and so forth. And all of this rhyme scheming and voltaing and whatnot seems to get in the way of what that poet William Wordsworth once called the spontaneous overflow of powerful feeling that he, and I, these days many of us, feel is the mark of good poetry. That idea that poetry should feel somehow natural and organic and not forced and composed. And again, this is, you know, Wordsworth is one of the key figures in this kind of language war that I was discussing earlier, right? And he very much fell into the anti-Pope camp because he felt that poetry should somehow sound spontaneous, right? And not composed. And it is true that many poets find all the restrictions of the sonnet annoying. In fact, a few years after Keats wrote Chapman's Homer, he wrote another poem whose first line is, "If by dull rhymes our English must be changed." It's basically a sonnet in which he complains about the traditional sonnet's rhyming requirements. It's a sonnet that's partially annoyed at sonnets. And yet, despite this, Keats and poets before Keats and poets since Keats kept on writing sonnets, even though they were kind of annoyed by them. And I think it might be partly because it's these rules, these kind of anally fiddling rules, that while they're annoying, also make the form seem like a challenge. Right? The challenge being, how do you make a poem sound natural and not forced while still following these rules, or at least some of the rules, and while taking advantage of the sonnet's real strength as a form? And that strength is its ability to convey an image or an idea in a kind of brief and powerful burst, which is to say, you only have 14 lines, show me what you got, right? You don't have time to dither around in a sonnet. It's just, it's got to be there or it's not there, right? So the rules become a thing to adhere to, but also to surmount, and ultimately to create something beautiful and powerful. But now that we know something about the sonnet, the next question is, specifically, how does knowing about the form help us appreciate Chapman's Homer? And one way is that for the reader, you know, if we start to look like things, if we start to look at things or look for things like the Volta, the poet's manipulation of the form, looking into those things can really call attention to interesting things that the poet is trying to say. In this case, that Keats is trying to emphasize or subtly hint at or point to or suggest. One example of this is, again, figuring out where the Volta is. In Chapman's Homer, the Volta seems to come at the obvious point in line 9, when the poem changes course, and the line is, "Then I felt like some watcher of the skies." Then, as in "then felt I like some watcher of the skies," indicates a kind of shift in the poem's tone and direction. And then, of course, that's followed by two similes. The last two lines are two similes. The first one is one in which the speaker thinks of himself as an astronomer, or imagines himself as an astronomer watching, watching or observing a new planet that hasn't been seen before. And then the second simile is the one in which he relates himself to the explorer Cortes. One could argue, though, that even before this line, "Then felt I like some watcher of the skies," you have an indication of a change earlier when the speaker says, "Yet I never did breathe its pure serene until Chapman," etc., etc., etc. And this is important because this is the moment in the poem when the speaker marks his discovery of Chapman. And of course, Chapman is the author that really opens his eyes, right, to the kind of wonders of the places that he's heard about, right, or that he's maybe sort of been to but never been able to fully appreciate, right? So this line also arguably acts as a juncture between the first and second halves of the poem, and it's an important one because the poem is all about how Chapman acts as an intermediary between Homer and the speaker. And so we have these kind of two potential Voltas, or we have, you know, the Volta and then the kind of Volta, right? And thinking about each one of them highlights different aspects of the poem. The line 9 Volta, which is, you know, the actual Volta, takes us into these similes that really take the poem in a whole new direction. But that line in which the poem pivots to Chapman again highlights or underscores just how important Chapman is and Chapman's role is to everything else that follows, right? So that's just one way in which thinking about the Volta, where the Volta might be, or the possible Volta, or the quasi-Volta, can kind of bring things out of the tapestry, right, and kind of make them pop in front of us, okay? And this idea of the kind of the almost Volta and the real Volta in some ways is, I think, echoed in the last 8 lines with those two similes. Pretty much, you know, I would argue that you have a kind of weak simile and then a stronger simile, right? And one of the reasons that I really love, or one of the many things about this poem that's fantastic, is that I think that starting off with the one simile and then moving on to the other one, right? "I felt like this," or "I felt like this," it gives off the impression that the speaker is thinking out loud, which again makes the poem seem more organic. But again, we have first the simile of the speaker as the astronomer, and then Cortes. And this is very crucial. Helen Vendler, for example, points out that the astronomer can't actually visit any of the places that he sees. He can look at them, but he can't actually go. So the poem begins with this one simile, but then it moves past it to the more active simile, right, in which the speaker compares himself to Cortes, the guy who's actually walking on this new ground and not just observing it from afar. But it's in this last simile, this Cortes simile, that Keats makes, or seemingly makes, his big mistake when he says he feels like stout Cortes when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. And why is this a mistake? Well, to get into that, we have to do some background work on who Cortes actually is. Keats here is referring to Hernán Cortés, the Spanish conquistador who in 1520 famously destroyed the powerful Aztec Empire and killed its leader, Montezuma. And then Cortés, of course, went on to do a whole bunch of well-known and these days fairly controversial things, which include wandering around the Baja Peninsula and then becoming the ruler of Oaxaca. So Cortes, you know, was all around Central America in the early 1500s, but he was never actually in Darien, which is, of course, where he is in the poem. Darien is in Panama, and Cortes never went there. The guy who did go to Panama and who was credited with being the first European to see the eastern side of the Pacific was this guy, Vasco Núñez de Balboa. Totally different guy, right? So what is happening here, right? Well, for a long time, people thought that Keats simply mixed up two Spanish guys. And you know, to a certain extent, that really makes sense. If you remember, he wrote the poem very quickly after being up most of the night. He ran it off to his friend the next morning. It seems logical that he would get one Spanish explorer mixed up with another Spanish explorer. Right, this is what, you know, you can kind of dismiss this at first glance. But the more you think about it, the more this seems really strange. Because, you know, fine, Keats, you know, gets it mixed up in his poem. But no one seems to have pointed out this mistake until the mid-19th century. In the mid-19th century, well, in 1861, the poet Alfred Tennyson, really famous guy, made a note in an anthology that indicated that he thought Keats messed up. He basically wrote, well, what we actually need here is Balboa, not Cortes, right? And this idea that Tennyson first propagated that Keats just got his historical facts mixed up, this went unchallenged for a long time.
Even today, a lot of articles written about the poem work under the general assumption that Keats simply made a mistake there, and then they go on to discuss the rest of the poem. And I think that this has to do with, or it ties back to, two separate but equally potent myths about Keats. One that existed during his lifetime, more or less, and one that was propagated more towards the end of his life and then into the later 1800s. The first one stems directly from those attacks that I had mentioned before by the conservative critics who disagreed with Keats's politics. And one of the things that they seized on in attacking Keats was his background and his education. Keats was the son of a stableman. He didn't have the kind of aristocratic background that other poets, other of his contemporaries like Lord Byron or Percy Shelley had. And similarly, he wasn't able to afford to go to a school like Eton or Harrow, where, again, Byron and Shelley went. He went to an alternative sort of progressive school that didn't have the kind of cachet that those other schools had. So he was attacked later on when he was writing poetry for his supposedly working class education and his working class background, which was said to be reflected in the crudeness of his poetry. This is one of the myths about Keats, or the stories about Keats that I said was popular or that was propagated by conservative critics when he was alive. The other myth, which is actually much more potent than the first one, is one that was started in his last years and then continued into the 1800s. And it's a crucial component of the later 19th century appreciation of him. And this is the idea of Keats as this ethereal, incredibly sensitive, overly refined, delicate poet who, as his friend Percy Shelley said, died because he had read a bad review of his poetry. And it's statements like this that were made by friends of his, that, you know, he was so sensitive that he couldn't bear to read people who attacked him and his writing. This is the kind of thing that then spurred this idea of Keats as the genius, angelic poet, far removed from the mundane, the political, and the earthy. And so, you know, if we go back to this Keats-Balboa mistake, I think you can use either one of these myths about Keats to kind of, you know, paper over it, right? If you ascribe to the first reading of Keats that he was just this uneducated bumpkin, well, then obviously he was bound to make a mistake like this to confuse one explorer with another because he didn't come from a good background, he didn't have a good education.
if you ascribe to the more popular second myth of Keats, Keats as the ethereal genius poet, I think then what happens is that the poem's greatness kind of papers over this one mistake, right? Because it doesn't matter that Keats made it, because the poem is otherwise flawless and wonderful. But I think that whichever reading that, whichever take on this you go with, both of them do an injustice to Keats, and it behooves us to more carefully examine what exactly happens when he puts Balboa, or he puts Cortez in the place of Balboa. The other thing about the mistake is that I think that it, or the idea that this simply could have been, you know, a thoughtless mistake, is that it also fits with our idea of Britain in the 19th century. When we think of Britain in the 1800s, particularly in the early 1800s, I think these days we tend to imagine manor houses and women in empire waist dresses and, you know, best of all, Mr. Darcy galloping along on a horse. We don't think about Spain or an interest in Spain and the New World and conquest. And I don't think that we pay that much attention necessarily to what was happening beyond the borders of England itself, because that's how Britain during this time period has been portrayed in our popular culture. Both these ideas, though, the idea that Keats was somehow both too sensitive and too refined and also something of a bumpkin, and the idea that England was basically just a perpetual garden party, both of these ideas are obviously incomplete. Now, Keats was not as overtly political a writer as his contemporaries Percy Shelley and Lord Byron. Nevertheless, he had a well-documented, if more muted, interest in the ideals of republicanism, of liberty, of equality or better conditions for the working poor. So to mark him or to characterize him as not interested in the contemporary and not interested in politics is to do a pretty grave disservice to his own interests in activism and justice. In particular, Keats was associated with a group of writers and thinkers who were collectively and derogatively known as the Cockney School. Their leader, or the guy around whom they all kind of coalesced, was this journalist named Leigh Hunt. Leigh Hunt, of course, published the newspaper The Examiner, which in December of 1816 published Keats's poem on first looking into Chapman's Homer. Geoffrey Cox is a critic of Keats's work who has done a really marvelous job of situating his poetry and kind of helping to dissolve that myth of Keats as the disinterested solitary poet. And he writes, quote, "To see Keats as part of the Hunt circle," and here Cox is referring to Leigh Hunt, "is to reveal the self-consciously ideological content of his poetry. To return Keats's poems to their immediate context in the Hunt circle and the cultural battles of their day is not to diminish their aesthetic qualities, but to credit the larger cultural project that Keats shared with the Hunt circle." And there's a number of poets and writers who Cox associates with the journalist Leigh Hunt. "It is to see Keats' involvement in the Cockney School as a political as well as a poetic education, and his growth as an ideological as well as a stylistic development." End quote. So here again, we can see how more recently there's been a move to push Keats away from the image of him that was really constructed in the late 1800s, and to provide a more complex figure of the poet that grounds him in the political, cultural realities of his time. In the same way that, you know, Keats, I think, has become a much more complex figure recently, Britain in the early 1800s wasn't just some pastoral tea party. It was, in fact, a rapidly growing empire that was facing a considerable amount of turmoil, both within its own borders as well as outside of itself. Now, for example, here is what's happening in 1816. Within England, you have riots breaking out in various parts of the country because of economic distress. You also have Britain sending soldiers all over the place.
including India, where it was rapidly consolidating its empire, and in the course of doing so, fighting many, many battles there. And beyond all of this, the country was still recovering from having had to fight the French and Napoleon, and in particular Napoleon, on and off all over the world since the 1790s. So what we have here is a war-torn, weary country that actually is incredibly engaged with and interested in global events because that is part of their reality. You have families in Britain who are and Ireland who are sending sons and brothers and relatives off to go fight wars, and they want to know about and are interested in things happening beyond their borders. And of course, even within their borders, you have all kinds of turmoil. Even in those novels, whose primary considerations seem to be the love lives and the, you know, social politics of the middle and upper classes, you can get a sense of what's happening outside, because even these novels tend to have seemingly throwaway references to global political events. I'm thinking specifically of novels like Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, and Persuasion. In those novels, you have references to sugar plantations in the West Indies and sea captains who are going off or have just come back from fighting in the Napoleonic Wars. And it's, I think, these clues, even in novels whose primary interest seems completely domestic, right, that demonstrates how much, or to the extent to which Britain was really suffused with a kind of global awareness. And it's for all these reasons, the, you know, more recent rediscovery of Keats as a ambitious, much more interesting thinker than was originally imagined, and also the restructuring of our ideas of Britain as less of a genteel agricultural society and more of a mercantilistic global empire, that I think that the Cortez-Balboa mix-up or mistake seems less likely to have stood for as long as it did. Yet one important point where you can see the new ideas of Keats coming together with the new ideas of Britain is the simple fact that Keats was, as it so happens, very knowledgeable about Central and South American history. It was a favorite topic of his. So it seems very unlikely that he wouldn't have caught his mistake, especially when we consider that he revised the poem several times before it was finally published. Moreover, he obviously wasn't the only person to read it. Even before it was published, it was read by a number of people. And then you have people like the critic John Wilson Croker, who really hated Keats and his poetry, and who would have lost no opportunity to mock Keats for doing something just like this. Croker is one of the ones who is really fond of bringing up what he sees as Keats' lack of a good education. So you can imagine that, you know, this would have been exactly the kind of thing that he would be looking for. So the fact that neither Keats, nor his admirers, nor his detractors seem to have caught what is a fairly obvious mistake really becomes more and more puzzling the more and more we think about it. And this very issue, this mistake, if it was a mistake, you know, what do we do with it? This has become an issue that has come up quite a bit in recent criticism. And one of the most important recent readings of this moment comes from a critic named Charles Zepka, who has made the, I think, is fairly audacious argument that Keats's replacement of Cortez for Balboa isn't a mistake at all, but is in fact, or was in fact, deliberate. And Zepka's argument is quite complicated. There are many facets to it, and I'm not going to summarize it here, but I do want to focus on one of the pieces of evidence that he uses, which is a book called The History of America by William Robertson. And this was a book of Central and South American history that was very popular during Keats's time. It was a book that Keats had read. And Zepka hones in on the fact that in this book, Robertson suggests that Cortez
nearly went to Panama. What Jepka points out is that Robertson's language at that part in his history is really ambiguous and makes it easy to think that Cortez maybe did go to Panama when in fact he only almost went to Panama but ultimately didn't. So it's possible that a number of people were confused or not entirely sure whether or not Cortez had ever made it to Panama or not. However, as Jepka himself points out, even if Keats did think that Cortez went to Panama because of the ambiguous language in that book by William Robertson, that still doesn't quite explain the poem's final image of the conqueror staring out onto the Pacific, because this is an image that is intimately connected to Balboa and has nothing whatsoever to do with Cortez. In William Robertson's History of America, he has a passage in which he very clearly describes Balboa climbing up a mountain to look over the Pacific Ocean for the first time. And one of the things about this passage that's important aside from this is that Robertson has Balboa climb up alone, which is again changed in Keats's poem. And we'll come back to that, the fact that he goes up there, you know, with a group of soldiers in a little bit. In any case, using Robertson and then, as I mentioned, several other arguments that I'm not going to get into, Jepka's point is, quote, by placing Cortez on a peak in Darien that he barely missed climbing in the company of or even in advance of his predecessor, and by predecessor, Jepka means Balboa, in 1513, and by placing him in a scene haunted by the aura of Balboa's original discovery, Keats emphasizes the geographical and dramatic congruence of these two historically disparate moments, thereby underscoring the crucial gap in time traversed by Cortez in his belated arrival on the shores of the sublime Pacific. End quote. And that's the end of Jepka for right now. But what does this actually mean? What this basically means is that Keats put Cortez in Balboa's place because he liked what that deliberate rewriting implied. What it implied is that Cortez, in fact, did come late to the party, that he's standing in the shadow of Balboa, and yet he's having the kind of sublime moment that we associate with getting somewhere first. He's having this moment of what we would consider a kind of original sublimity, but in fact, he got there second. And this idea of someone coming later and having a sublime moment and having it happen after it's already happened, you know, is completely appropriate to a poem whose sole purpose is to capture the experience of reading a translation, which is, of course, a secondhand, right, experience, a kind of rewriting of the original. And that this reading of the translation can itself be a sublime experience, which I have to say is not necessarily what we associate with reading a translation, right? A lot of people may describe a moment of being carried away by reading the work of an author that they've never read before. But very rarely do you hear someone say, oh yeah, I read this translation and it was, you know, it was totally awesome. But that is exactly what Keats is doing in the poem. And for him, Chapman's Homer stands in the original place in the same way that Cortez in the sonnet stands in the place of Balboa. This is basically Jepka's argument, and I find it incredibly interesting and persuasive. I should mention, though, that it's not without its detractors. As these critics have pointed out, this assumption that Keats would make such a daring mashup, which really what it is pretty speculative because it relies on the premise that Keats would have been okay with a good number of his audience just reading it and deciding that it was a mistake on the hopes that others would read it and realize that his mistake was in fact a very clever non-mistake, you know, and there is something rather, or possibly rather tenuous about this. And this is a debate that I think will continue for some time and has no probable resolution because it's unlikely that we will ever know what was going on in Keats's mind when he wrote Cortez in for Balboa. The point, though, is that whether this is a mistake or a mashup or an unconscious slippage or whatever, the fact that Balboa lurks in the shadows of Cortez is really crucial for the reasons that I've mentioned. because of what it says about translation, but also because it means that Keats wrote the name of a man who was understood to be a conqueror, that is Cortez, in place of a guy who was generally understood to be an explorer, that's Balboa. So he writes a conqueror in place of an explorer. And this for me is really crucial because it highlights a central tension in the poem, or a point that Keats is trying to explore, and that is the relationship between discovery and creation, or between merely reading something and doing something. So let's go back to those last lines again. Or like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. That's that last bit. And what for me is very interesting is that, as I've said, Keats revises Robertson's description in the History of America, where he describes Balboa summiting the peak alone, and instead he has Cortez do it with a bunch of his men next to him. And I think it's important to note that they're not communicating with each other, Cortez and his men, but they are all there at this moment. And there are two things about this that are noteworthy. The first has to do with what is for me one of the most telling revisions to the poem that Keats made after that first version that his friend got while sitting at the breakfast table. In that first version, Keats has Cortez stare at the Pacific with wondering eyes. But in the final published version of the poem, Keats changed wondering eyes to eagle eyes. And this, of course, makes Cortez seem much less uncertain and much more commanding. So now we have a commanding Cortez staring at the Pacific alongside his men, who are looking at each other, not the Pacific, but at each other, and they are looking with a wild surmise. And what does surmise mean? Surmise means to make a guess with no evidence, to just throw yourself out there and hope that things turn out okay. So we have an incredibly arresting image of contrasts, the commanding eagle-eyed Cortez staring out at all the worlds that he has conquered or is planning to conquer, and his bewildered soldiers all looking at each other, not quite sure what the heck is happening. And I think that with this final line, Keats captures the line between explorer and conqueror, between wandering around and looking for something, and mastery, right, between learning something and making something. And I want to make it clear that I think he's interested in the interplay between these two things. At the same time, he definitely ultimately privileges the commanding Cortez as conqueror over the guessing, wondering, more passive, surmising soldier / Balboa. And with this interplay, what the poem, I think, ultimately does an amazing job of representing is how scary it can be to move from simply learning about something or reading about something to actually writing about something or doing something with the knowledge that you've gained. I mean, any one of us who has stared at a blank piece of paper, you know, in which we need to write something, knows how much just putting those first words down on paper can feel like taking a leap into the unknown, right? And being a writer is also about taking command. It's about taking charge of and owning whatever it is that you're going to put on the page. And I think Keats captures the nervousness, the suspense, the feeling that as a writer you're out there on some promontory looking out at vast expanses and having to make decisions that are going to be in the public eye and that you can't back away from later or repudiate. So that this poem on first looking into Chapman's Homer, which is all about coming second, coming after, translation instead of the original, this is also Keats telling everyone that he's ready to step out onto the summit. He's read what he's read, he's been inspired by whoever he's been inspired by, and now it's time for him to stop merely reading and to actually start writing. Great. And that's fantastic. But it's not the only thing happening here. The other thing about this final image that is so potent is that Cortez isn't alone. And as much as this is a poem about discovering one's own independent voice, about moving from just becoming a guy who sails through the Western Isles to one who might actually become a leader of one of these isles, right, or these realms, right? This is a poem that's about community. The speaker isn't going it completely alone. He, like Cortez, has people with him, all of these people that he's read and absorbed, right? And this is about how other people's work and thinking can lead to new insight. And it's a bold move in my mind, because this isn't necessarily how we like to think about literature or really any other ambitious venture, right? We want to think about Cortez or Balboa or whoever standing up there on that peak by himself. You don't want him to have a whole crowd of people behind him, right? In the same way, we like to think about authors, you know, being hit with a kind of blinding inspiration, right, about a kind of original genius. We don't necessarily like to think about how writing is, in fact, an incredibly communal act, right? So what Keats does is that he writes a poem that is, again, about, you know, finding your independent voice and like, taking that final leap and becoming a writer, but it's also about the sublimity and the wonderfulness of coming in second or being later in line, and how greatness comes from that tension between the influence of others and the creation of your own independent voice. And somehow in this poem, he's able to convey an experience both of newness and second-handedness. And he makes those things merge together and demonstrates how they're not necessarily opposites. Keats has taken, again, what for most people would be at most a fairly mundane experience, reading a translation, and he's turned it into this nuanced, complex, historically and culturally layered exploration of what it means to be starting out as a writer, to be taking the first step into a bigger world. And it's really not bad for a poem of only 14 lines.
For more information on this podcast and to see a list of sources that I used in preparation for the show, please go to litoutloud.org. Thank you.